Thanks a lot, Three. It's really a great pleasure to be at this wonderful place, a very exciting program. It's a little at the borderline of my activity, and that's, in that sense, you learn much more. So this is a great pleasure. And it's a quite sort of fundamental thing I will talk about, namely how to oscillate a couple. And we will talk about one internal, one external, and then you get what's called Arnold tongues. I will talk quite a lot about that, shown up here. And it's really, really an old problem, as I will tell you. And actually, I worked on it when I was at University of Chicago 35 years ago.
Something. Ah.
Yes, yes, yes. I worked on it in fluids. I'll show you a few slides on that, and then kind of completely forgot about it until 3-4 years ago, where we begin to look at biological oscillators. And in biology, we learned, and probably you all know, there are lots of oscillators. Cell cycle, very fundamental, circadian, got Nobel Prize this year, right? Calcium oscillation, embryo, and protein oscillations, often from DNA damage. And this is what I will focus about. We have worked on for the last 5 years. And I don't know, you don't need to know much biology here, but anyhow, I will show, of course, a little bit. The idea is that we have protein inside a single cell that oscillate up and down in time, and they are regulated what's called negative feedback loop. I introduce what that is. And we have concentrated on three very famous ones, P53, NF-kappa-B, and Wnt. And I'll tell you a little bit about why they are important. They relate to DNA damage, inflammation, and embryo segmentation. But it's well known that cells related to these transcription factors will oscillate. And then we got the idea to ask our experimental friends, or first we did a model to try to externally oscillate and then see it couples. And here comes my attachment to this program. We can teach the cell to change its oscillations and it can get memory. And we get these Arnold tongues, and then we are very interested in what's called overlap, because then we get mode hopping. And how's that related to memory? This is what I come to. So I was very fortunate to get contact to an experimental group in Chicago now, actually at that time in Zurich. And when memory is short, we experimentally observe a lot of mode hopping, and we speculate, this is a speculation, where there's a way to control cells. You had a question?
No, you said mode coupling, the same mode.
Mode hopping, I'll introduce what it is. It's simply a hopping between two different modes of the system. we discussed at lunch whether it's a new word or I don't know. But, so, of course, relating to this program, we have tried recently to look at time correlations, and it turns out that if one of these modes dominate, one tongue dominate, we get stronger memory. And I hope I get time to come to this. This is really work over the last 4 years with mostly Sandeep Krishna from Bangalore. Many people here are from Bangalore. And actually, it was suggested to us by my old late mentor, Leo Kapanoff, and so on. And we have several papers, in particular one here. We are very happy about, because we managed in cell systems a year ago to combine theory and experiment. So let me start with a graphical abstract of that paper. I think I told you about it here. So idea is cell oscillate, and they can oscillate in two states. This is what we talk about today, two modes. That's what we call it, mode hopping. And now we come from outside with an oscillator, and then it turns out we can switch between these two states as time goes. This is the whole idea. We call it mode hopping. And also we found that if you put large amplitude from outside, we actually get into a chaotic state and so on. And we now talk to experimentalists whether we can see it or not. Not clear yet. And the whole idea is, this mode hopping, does it have any biological, what should we say, influence? And this is still a speculation, but we work with models where we indeed see that in one state, some genes are producing a lot, in the other state, other genes are producing a lot. We call it multiplexing. Now I go back in time quite a lot. 400 years, how much? I can't even calculate, 350 years. Huygens, and I think actually Leo Kapanoff found this picture to me. It's a great drawing. Okay, the story, so following Huygens had a fever, was in bed. And you know, he had nothing to do, so he had two clocks on the wall. I don't know why he drew it like this. And he realized, as we all know, suddenly they synchronized. And then he devised this ingenious setup, which he actually built with his father, I also learned reading. Two clocks here, two chairs, and a piece of wood in between. And he found if they were close to each other, they synchronized. If they were far apart, they didn't. So of course, the closer they are, the more they interact. And the further apart, they... Very simple, right? By the way, for the whole talk, very important also for the cells, two independent oscillators. We all know we have a spring and we drive it. This is a resonance phenomena, right? You hit the resonance and the eigenfrequency. Here we have two independent, and this is a very subtle difference I'm very happy to discuss. Okay, with two modes, two oscillators, what can we have? They can be rationally related, so we get a periodic. This is just for a pendulum, just so you know. It has a periodic limit cycle, as we call it. If they are irrationally related, we get a quasi-periodic solution that never closes on itself. It's ergodic in phase space. And we all know you can excite many modes. You can a broad band spectrum and get a chaotic motion. This is the two possibilities for two frequencies that couple. I think we all know at least a sort of basic dynamical systems theory, but what comes out is the Arnoton diagram, which might look simple, but in fact is extremely deep in my opinion. Here we have, say, one of the frequencies moving here, and here's the coupling. Ah, so if the, say, external frequency is close to the internal, we get what we call the one-to-one Arnoton. What does this mean? Maybe I go here. That you can vary the external frequency and pull the internal frequency so they are exactly one-to-one, but over an interval. And that interval increases when they couple. That makes sense. Ah, if the external one is half the internal frequency, you also get an interval where the external will pull, entrain, mode lock, phase lock, many names, the internal one over an interval. And the really, really deep thing is that for each rational number, you will get a tongue. Ah, here comes an interesting thing I always tell my students, and I tell you now, they all, for each and every rational number, there's a tongue that widens. The rational numbers are dense. Now I claim the following, they can all widen without overlap. Think about this. How can that be? In any epsilon interval, there's infinity of rational numbers. They all widen. I do epsilon smaller, they all widen epsilon smaller. And all my students go away and say, it's not possible. And the best one come back two weeks later say, it is possible. I have thought about this for many years, and I think it's quite interesting. Yeah?
So the frequency that you have here is one of the oscillators.
One of the oscillators. One you fix, and you vary the other. It's the ratio.
The
it's the ratio one to the other. So driving, say, is the big omega, right?
Okay. But you have a total of three frequencies.
No, two.
Ratios.
No, two. Five. Internal or external, say, or whatever you would call it.
So the two internal.
Two clocks.
The two oscillators have the same internal frequency.
No. I mean, I vary one. One, say, you keep.
Okay.
One, you
no
keep.
No driving, right? There's clock number one and clock number two.
Yeah.
This one, no driving. Okay.
Yeah. Well, you could call it driving.
Well, okay.
I mean, it's
you
a.
You call one driving the other.
You can exactly, Bulbul. It's you can. I think people do that.
Okay. And KK is the coupling constant.
Just a measure for the coupling constant.
And what's the difference between the light purple and the dark purple?
That's a very good question. Thank you. This is I call the Ising diagram for two frequencies. But in what we try to say now for some years is this picture is universal in a sense. They might bend, they might move. But you always get this infinity of tongues as soon as you have two. It's a completely universal phenomenon of nature, in my opinion. Thank you very much. They all widen. And now I claim they don't overlap. But at some point, it doesn't go anymore. At some point, they must overlap. This is what we call the critical line here. So above this line, the tiniest starts to overlap. That's why we put a different color. And here I show the overlap up here in green, right? That's further. The tiniest will overlap at this critical line. In the red one, what's this, I suppose you will ask. In the red one, many tongues overlap. And there you can have chaotic motion. when two overlap, this is what we do for the cells. Two overlap, then one can be stable, the other can be stable, depending on initial conditions. So it depends on initial conditions. That's why it can mode hop between the two.
Are all of these straight lines for very small amplitudes?
Down here?
Yeah. Yeah. Straight lines of slope 45 degrees?
thank you. Also good question. That's one of the few things. This is actually for a circle map, which is ideal Ising model of two frequencies. You can prove analytically this is straight for the one-to-one.
Not the others.
They bent. And my friend Sandeep says they must bend, but in order not to overlap. Because if they didn't bend, then you, as I told you before, the rational numbers are dense, they must overlap if they didn't bend. So it's a little bit deep. I think we have understood what goes on down here. And this is really kind of a Russian invention. That's why it's called Arnold. But many Russian mathematicians have worked on this. It's really number theory, right? But we have actually no clue what happens up here when they start to overlap. There are infinite amount of bifurcations and so on. And that's, in some sense, for me, very funny that we can put biological systems up here and see what happens.
So due to the tongues, you have this fractional faction of frequencies.
Yes, yes, yes.
As the steady state,
after transient, of course, after transient. But it will find that ratio. And therefore, since there is an interval of one of them, it must move the other.
But do you mean you have no clue? These days is a solvable problem. Like even I could put it on a computer, can't I?
It's so complicated, Jim, that when they start to overlap, you see an infinity of bifurcations, back and forth, and pair doublings, and but you are right. You are right. You can put it on a computer, and you can stare forever. I guess I was saying from a mathematical, rigorous point of view.
The dashed lines are not really there, right? So,
Well, they are because you go through various 7-point bifurcations.
So they are basically unstable or whatever.
Good point. Yeah. So, good point. Thank you very much. So, let's say you have two tongues starting to overlap.
Yeah.
Aha! Number theoretically, there are infinity in between. So we find two overlapping, two stable. But you have an infinity of unstable. So when are they stable and when are they unstable? We don't know either. But of course, from a physical, biological point of view, only the stable ones are the relevant ones. Are they? No, because sometimes you are pushed away from the unstable ones in the dynamics. But you will, after a transient, see the stable ones. Was that an answer?
Okay, maybe.
Go ahead.
Suppose I stay below k equals 1.
Right.
Okay, and I basically fix k at 0.75.
Yeah.
And I start in one of those boundaries, say in the 0 over 1 boundary, and I go towards the boundary where it stops.
Then you get a saddle node bifurcation.
But why can I, just by looking at the signal, can I see that I'm approaching the boundary?
Oh, yes, because this is called, bottleneck.
So I'm in the 0-1, I'm approaching from the 0 over 1, the boundary.
I get you. You come from the white in there, right?
So I come from the purple.
You come from the purple. Oh, okay. But you can see both ways.
Okay.
You come from a stable, but really from the other side, it's called a bottleneck, right? You begin to read a stable state.
But because there's presumably, when you come from the white, there's an infinity of other rational numbers.
Exactly.
And so forth. That's why I was saying.
Indeed, they are. But of course, when you, like Jim says, why don't you put it on a computer? You try to find the simplest one, right? So you overlook the others, but they are there on the way. You're right. But they might have infinite transient. Yes?
I still don't understand what this diagram means.
Good. I think it's a great diagram, happy.
One question immediately comes along. Technically speaking, is at any point here, is the motion chaotic?
No. Not at all down here, so you can define this line as an onset of chaos. Tiny, tiny, tiny points here for bigger tongues up here. Complicated.
But what distinguishes the white from the blue?
The white are all the smaller tongues and the quasi periodic solution.
So you haven't really even really defined tongue, you see.
What?
You haven't even really defined
tongue. I thought I had. I'm completely happy to
It's a pointy triangle.
I define again, Jim. I'm completely happy. I'm completely happy to define again. Listen, we have an internal frequency I call little omega. I don't move that.
Yeah.
I move the external.
Yeah, yeah.
They couple with a strength K.
Yeah.
What do I mean by a tongue? Let's say for a certain coupling strength, a half, I can move the external over an interval and pull the internal. So they keep one-to-one frequency ratio. That's the definition. That's the definition.
Locked.
You entrain, you pull, you mode lock. It has many names. And the stronger they couple, the longer interval externally you can pull the internal, so they mode lock. I think it's completely exactly well defined.
And in the white areas, they're going from one to the other.
The white area. Okay, so they are in. Now Jim says, why don't you put it computer? I have done, I tell you. I think I found, well, that's some years ago, probably 20,000 tongues here. 20,000 tongues. So in the white, they are the small ones. I told you in the beginning, you can have quasi-periodic incommensurate, you solid-state people call it solutions. What are incommensurate solutions? That's when the ratio is irrational. That only happens in a point. That means all the irrational numbers.
Between these two.
Between these two lie on straight on lines that bends. And here comes number theory. So on the real axis down here, I'm completely happy to talk about this. You can see that we might not get to biology, but that's fine. On the real axis, rational numbers are dense, have zero measure. Irrational have full measure. There are many, many irrationals. The funny thing, what happens to the critical line is now all the numbers are there, but the rational numbers have full measure. The irrational numbers sit on points in between and now have zero measure, but they are all there. Amazing. They sit on a fractal we have found. Yes?
If it's irrational, are these really locked?
No, they are not locked. They are unlocked, irrational, unlocked, incommensurate.
These
locked,
are,
commensurate.
So that in fact it
just sits in between.
Yeah, but it keeps on going irregularly.
Keeps on going, and ergodically, it never comes back.
These are quasi-periodic.
Quasi-periodic. Incommensurate, you guys call it. Exactly the same.
The power spectrum for all of these is discrete.
Yes, they would be. I mean, for the two frequency, of course, you just see the 2 points, but they are not locked to each other. You see the two peaks.
In the quasi periodic.
You will still see 2 peaks, exactly. See 2 peaks.
It's more like it's information about the lifetime of sentience that's not shown in this paper. Transients.
No transient here. Of course.
That's shown here.
Good point. On any boundary, transient is infinite. Any boundary, by definition. Terrible on the computer, by the way, Jim. But I figured a way how to get around that. Long story. But transients are infinite on the boundaries, by definition.
That's a reason that experimentally you wouldn't see the skinniest possible.
That's a really good point. That's a really good point. You have infinite transient. What the hell does that mean, right? Very good point. But here we know exactly how to get around it in these models. Actually, I found a long time ago a way to find these points exactly by taking high-order derivatives. And we can talk about this. So I'm really happy we discussed this picture because I think it's quite fundamental. And as Sue knows, our friend Pierre Bach worked on that many years ago.
So because you mentioned that, isn't this sort of similar to the ANI model
baseline? Yeah. But ANI model is, you have a Hamiltonian.
Correct. No, I'm not saying
but
that
it's
the
similar.
Same, but
it's,
I'm saying
it's,
the baseline.
It's exactly the same, but the diagram behaves in a different way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, yeah. Yeah, please.
Besides 1 to 1 and 1 to 2, have any other mode of fitness been observed?
You cannot imagine what we did 35 years in the basement of Chicago. I show in a second. Amazing.
Biological.
Or biological. No, there we have noise, and that's the whole point with the memory, and I speak here. But in the fluid of Albert Liebscher-Bär, we got onto denominators 100. And you cannot imagine. I'm still amazed by this.
Experimentally.
I show. So if you Google Arnold tongues, you get very beautiful diagrams on the net. And I am in California, so I always show this. And I don't show it in Europe. So I also have to brag here. We actually managed to get Arnold tongues in the front page of Cell Systems a year ago. And you know what the editor said? He said, "Oh, I don't care about Arnold tongues, but it looked like sunrise." So anyhow, actually, I think it's quite beautiful. But here you see the tongues go this way. He said, "No, I turn it because then you see, oh, it looks like water." And okay, I never thought about this. Okay, going back. So as I said, I worked on this 35 years ago and haven't done since a few years ago again. As probably some of you know, that Liebscher-Bär devised a very ingenious convection experiment, very controlled. You heat from below, you have two rolls. It's you know, a few centimeters. So on that scale. And after you heat a little more, you have a so-called oscillatory instability. Extremely stable. As we talked about at lunch, it could go for weeks. It could go for weeks. What's the time scale? Around 5 seconds or something? So what they did was also they put a bolometer here and measure temperature. And this is what plotted here. This is the temperature going up and down. Extremely stable. That comes now. Yeah. So this is a period doubling sequence. He did more, one period doubling, two period doubling, going into chaos, right? Beautiful thing. But then I came there and talked about Arnold tongues, and they became very interested. So they used mercury, and now they put an oscillating current in the cones because mercury is conducting. Very smart. Very smart. What did we get? Arnold tongues has led to an incredible degree. We could find this around so-called golden mean denominators around 100. And I'm still amazed because even on a computer, that's hard. And I mean, transient times, of course, really long, but still within. And here I would like to say already now, this I consider a completely deterministic system where noise is so small here. And that's why it's so interesting to use the same thing in biology, where noise is kind of infinite and it behaves completely different, except for the fact we also have the tongues. But noise makes life complicated, as you know. Inside a tongue, we could find period doublings. We could find all kind of overlaps. This is the pseudium. You have all kind of bifurcations. That's all kind of overlaps, chaotic transitions, and I don't know what. So a two frequency system can behave really crazy.
It's deterministic in terms of equations.
It was maybe loosely used. You have Navier-Stokes, you have convection, you have the whole song and dance. But I guess I just say it in a way that noise was so low. I mean, so I would say it's as close as deterministic as you can come in a fluid system. Then other people, I just show briefly at Harvard, people have used semiconductors to have two frequencies also. And unfortunately, Joey Paulson left because I wanted to show this for him. We talked about just density wave last week down in at UCLA, now also a long time ago. They did sliding just density wave with oscillating voltage across and could see all kind of details about this mode lock. So, around 4 years ago, with my very good old late mentor friend, Leo Kadanoff, we sat down and think about why biologists didn't try to think about this, because there are so many oscillators. I mean, actually, we, if you look inside us, everything oscillates, kind of. So, and in some sense, you can say, okay, if I have a steady state, what's the next simplest dynamics with it? It's of course a sinusoidal, right? We all know. And yeah, as I said before, but let me say again, circadian rhythm got Nobel Prize this year, right? And actually, in circadian clocks, people have looked a little bit at Arnold tongues, but very little. But circadian clocks has. Why? I have had, of course, jet lag all this week, 9 hours. But you can move. You can move the 24 hours. People do it in cyanobacteria, in other mouse and so on. You put in a cave and you change from 24 hours and can go down to 20 and up to around 28. 28, yeah. 4 hours each, and they still function. You can change that clock. It's a, of course, pure two oscillator problem again, they still function. But away from 24 hours, it kind of doesn't work. I mean, lower than 20 hours, it sort of goes wrong. Okay, so now I begin to go a little bit into biology, but I'm very happy we had this general discussion. Okay, so when do biological system oscillates? That's when you have what we call a negative feedback loop. I guess most people know, but nevertheless, when we have an arrow, it means if you have a lot of one, it could be a protein, or it could be a number of species, say on an island or whatever. If you have a lot of one, you get many twos. However, if you had a lot of twos, you get few threes. This is this dagger here, right? So. Positive regulation, negative regulation. I guess most of you know. But anyhow, if you have an odd number of the negative ones, you have a negative feedback loop. And a very famous one, I think the first talk, and I have looked at it many times, was exactly in this room by Michael Illovich, I think in 2000, called Repressor-Later by Illovich and Leibler. And they also built it in into bacteria. And you just have three genes that negatively repress each other. But you can do it simpler, I'll show you in a second. You can just have a gene that negatively regulates itself. But you need a time delay. Time delay is small, you get steady state, damped oscillation, sustained oscillations. So this is what you need, a negative regulation in order to oscillate. If you have positive feedback, if I had an even number of these negative ones here, you get what we call a switch, either in a high state or in a low state, the positive feedback. But I would like to show you some of the first data that came on oscillating proteins. And this is quite new, you see. Well, first, it's absolutely the first data, so 15 years ago. And now there are many data coming up. I'll show a little bit later. But this is mouse embryo cells. You put on a culture, and they saw that density of messenger RNA oscillate up and down with around a period of 2 hours. And the associated protein also. we actually looked at that. That's the first time I came into it. That's some time ago. And then we didn't think about coupling at that time, but only to think about oscillation. Here I have a drawing. Yep, sorry. Sure.
What's the cell cycle time for these cells?
Ah, that's a good question. It's it's around a day or something, half a day, yeah. But it's a very good question, because I think I can hear what you think. Oh, this could influence with the cell cycle, right? Yeah, that's a good point. But yeah, long story. Here I have just a picture of the cell with the nucleus. And we have a protein called HES1 that comes and binds to its own gene. But it does it in a little bit stupid way, because if it comes here and binds to the promoter of the gene or operator side, it cannot read the gene. So it's a negative regulation. It is negative on itself, we say. What do I mean by this? Because if it promoted, it will produce more. Here it blocks the gene. It's the protein blocks its own gene. And then you have the messenger, and you know this cycle, right? You get the protein, and you have this cycle back and forth. You have transcription and translation, I guess you all know. So we started to write down the equation. Aha, density of protein is proportional to how many messenger you are. This is the translation and the degradation. Very simple. And what time derivative of messenger has to do with how often this is free. Because if it's free, you read it, If it's not, you don't. And a degradation term. So two coupled ordinary differential equation. And then in this business, you always write sigmoid function, what's called Hill functions. You always do this because you want a saturation. It's a long story, but we all do that all the time. And you see, I have Hess below here. Why? Because if I have a lot of this protein, I produce less. If this is big, I get little messenger. And then we introduced a time delay. We, as I showed you before, we need to do this. So this is two coupled ordinary nonlinear differential equations, relatively simple, but with a time delay. And when we put in, actually that paper came with a lot of parameters, and this is always a problem in this business, to fairly high accuracy, we could reproduce the data kind of to a very high degree with a right time scale of 2 hours. Here you see first come the messenger, then come the protein as it should. Protein is stashed, and so on and so forth. And here you see again the problem. This is deterministic, it's smooth, and this is definitely noisy. It's stochastic. Anyhow, so this just to show you where we began now some years ago. And then I have used quite a lot of time over the last 10 years to look at these three protein, and I don't expect you at all to understand the details here, but this we call a genetic network. So here we have the cell, and we have all the proteins that we think is involved in the dynamics of that. And p53 is the most studied protein in the world. Has to do because half of all cancers has mutation of p53. And people believe that high level of p53 prevent cancer. So it's so a group at Harvard, Galit Lahav, where I go next week, do DNA damage. And what they see is P53 oscillate up and down. NF-kappa-B, which I will continue today, has to do with the inflammation. If the system is inflamed, protein oscillate up and down. And what's called wind is related to development, our spinal cord. Wind are oscillating up and down, also with a period of 2 to 4 hours. So this, my graduate students has worked on it, and we try to simplify this network because it's too complicated. You see, you had 20 proteins, and I used to say you multiply by 3 because you have 3 parameters per variable. So you have 60 unknown parameters in this. So we try to simplify. Here I want to make a little comment. I have given this talk often to biologists, and they say, why do you want to simplify? I say, I am a physicist. We study Ising model. What is Ising model? Okay. We try to simplify to understand the core. And I deeply believe this is the right way, but it's controversial always. They say, no, take the full network, take your 20 variables and your 60 parameters, and then do the whole thing. I say, I don't know the parameters. No, but then you have your computer, right, and you can study. So this is a controversial point, which has surprised me a lot. In what we do is, and our friend Sandeep is the master here, which try to find the network, the feedback loop, and forget about what's called downstream genes. What's not relevant for the feedback loop, we delete. And biologists cannot take it. Because they say, oh, but I work down here. You're not allowed to delete my protein. It's not a joke, it's the truth. So, but this, keeps the fun going. Anyhow, so you see, we, in all three cases, were able to write three coupled nonlinear ordinary differential equations. They are quite nonlinear, and it's a long, long story. I don't have time to, but because the degradation terms, which are always here, are quite nonlinear. And how does that come about? Because you see, there's a standard, completely old-fashioned chemical kinetics. If time scales are fast and you make a complex, you say it's equilibrium. It's equilibrium kinetics, back and forth fast. We learned that in school, right? And then we say it's equilibrium, and then you can invert the equations. And it's really smart. And that's why this nonlinear term comes. But long, long story. But anyhow, so You see, we get beautiful oscillations, and they're always two. There's a protein and its inhibitor. Protein and its inhibitor. Protein. What do I mean by inhibitor? That's the one that tries to degrade it. And in this case, always by making a complex. Try to make it non-free, I should say. And often we get this spikiness here. So anyhow, so this is work I've done with a lot of students. And anyhow, this is quite interesting because now we can, first of all, do analytic work on the fixed points of the steady state. As we all know, you find the steady state, and you do the Jacobian matrix, and you can see when it goes from a steady state into an oscillating state. So we look at the transitions. This is the first step, and then, as Jim says, the rest of the thing we mostly do on computers, and we can scan parameter space and things like this. So, so anyhow, I will probably jump a little bit, but we will focus on the NF-kappa-B system, and it's very important, one of the most important transcription factors in our body for inflammation, for all kinds of things. And these are experiments. There were two famous experiments 10 years ago, one by Baltimore, famous Baltimore Down in Caltech, and by Mike White in Liverpool. And they found that if you kind of inflammate a single cell, it oscillates up and down. And here you clearly see difference to the convection. You see a nice, but quite stable period nevertheless, quite stable period. And so this is the inhibitor, the green, and the red one is NF-kappa-B. And just to enhance what I showed before, this is the tree-coupled ordinary differential equation we have for this system. Is it negative feedback loop? Yes, we have one negative. Why? Because they couple in a complex and pulls I-kappa-B, pulls NF-kappa-B outside the cell. This positive because it promotes the gene of what's called I-kappa-B. So you have a negative feedback loop. So it should oscillate. Does it do? Yes, yes. And we could actually, by this model, reproduce all the experimental data with time scales and all kind of things. That's a really good point. We need the non-linearity of the degradation point to get the delay. We don't put specific. If you put in delay, as I showed you in the beginning, it's a pain in the neck mathematically because you go from a two-dimensional system to an infinite-dimensional system because of delays. Yeah. And to do stability analysis, I tried with postdoc and students, pain. So we try to avoid delay, and we get it from the nonlinearity. So
did you do some, yes, some analytical work on that beyond the stability analysis?
No, not really.
Because,
very,
you know, there's like techniques like the Kirilov-Polyakov-Magetic.
I know that
you could try to sort of.
I would be happy to. We tried a little bit. Maybe we tried too little, but you know, it gets. You see, this spiky, so you get very far away from the linear.
Yeah, but there's a theory of relaxational oscillator.
Also, relaxation oscillator. Absolutely, it's a relaxation oscillator. Absolutely, it is. So not really, but. Okay, just to show you, these are 2 years data, old data from Marcus Kovat at Stanford and Savas Thai. They work together in Chicago. But now it's better, but now they can have these single cell oscillate roughly for a little less than a week, four or five days. I think this is two, 3 days. But you see, quite nice oscillations, relatively smooth. So it's getting better and better. And actually, doing dynamical systems, you all know this technique. Oh, as we did with, some of us did with financial time series or whatever, you embed it. So they came and asked me, Marcus Kovat said, is this chaotic? I said, I don't know, I can try and look. You embed it, why, right? You have on x-axis, you have the real signal, on y-axis, you have the little delayed, and on z-axis, twice delayed. So you embed it, right? We tried also to do that many years ago with financial data and all. Not a big success, by the way. And, we know if it should be chaotic, it should have fractal layered structure. Does it have it? Not really. So it's too short. It's too short, yeah.
What were the three different colors in the last slide?
Before? Here or?
Yeah,
three different colors? Three different cells, very similar. Very similar. And here I tried, you see, with a little bit different embeddings. No, these are exactly two, thank you, two different cells. It's different embedding with these two. We cannot say, but I tell you, we are getting there. So that's why with Leo, Sandeep and I talked about, oh, since we cannot say this is chaotic, maybe we should try to do controlled experiments. Here the Arnoldson comes in.
This analysis will only allow you to see if there's a low dimensional.
Absolutely. Yes, but you believe maybe you have a single cell, right? I mean, if you have a population, it's a different story of cells, but you have a single cell, so you should believe there might be a low dimensional chaotic state, right? Why not? Or maybe not.
Please. But when you're trying to pull out a chaotic signal out of experimental data,
right,
you're always contending with noise as well.
Absolutely.
And so, it may be that, first of all, you don't have a very long sample.
Absolutely.
But it's also very hard if you've got a high noise level, and then you're in a more
difficult place. So right. So as we know, a deterministic Lorentz system, it traces up a strange attractor with a layered structure, with a fractal structure. What does noise do? It immediately smears it. But, we also try to do that with the convection experiment. Sometimes you can still see gaps in the so-called attractor, right? And you see gaps, it's not quasi-periodic. So there is a foggy area there where you can say something. But so it's okay, if we cannot say it's chaotic, then let us try to do something controlled. And now I just come back to the whole business from the very start. Oh, we tried first with the model, but let's try to modulate TNF, because all experiments by Baltimore and other people, they had fixed TNF. But very, very simple idea we came to think about. Let's oscillate from outside TNF. We have internal oscillator, let's oscillate that. Does it couple? We had no idea. So we used our equations, by the way, which I have here just so you see. I showed you the tree before. We get two more now from this external one that has to couple from this TNF over something called IKK. It doesn't matter really. I just want to show you the typical equations we work on. And here I have a slightly different drawing of the same feedback loop. But now we have the totally fundamental problem, which I claim is kind of universal, with two. By the way, that's why Leo liked it a lot, because it really has universal properties with these tongues.
Can you tell if something is chaotic or not if you only measure one of these variables in a chaotic? Or do you need to measure, because you're applying things in three dimensions?
Oh, but that's what people back time in chaos theory, that you can unfold by embedding just from one, right?
So that wasn't, those three axes were not three measured axes. That was you.
Just one. But they can measure. But you are, it's a good point. But the saying is that if you embed in large enough dimensions, then you in some sense read the others, right? Which is kind of true. Okay. So here comes the front page. That's why she liked it. You see, now I just want to show you these tongues. What does it mean in temporal? We people ask about transient and so on. Here we delete a transient. What is one to one? The external one is the green. The internal one is red. Aha! Are they entrained phase lock, mode lock, or whatever it's called? Yes, absolutely. And here comes the tricky thing. We talked about we can move the external frequency. What does that do? It moves the phase between the two. So for instance, I don't have it here, that peak has moved a little bit that way or move a little bit that way. But there's still mode block, but it moves the phase. That's another interesting thing one can try to look at. This is in the one-to-one tone. That's clear, I hope, right? Now, just as a pedagogical step, we take one to two. One to two means that I do two external PU to one internal. But you see, it's still completely locked, by the way, after a long transient. You have long transient. This is how you have another complication, which you can think about experimentally a lot. This one to two. Here comes, okay, down here it's not entrained. This is what we call quasi-periodic, it's not locked. Well, maybe it's to 1 over 500 or whatever, but to what we can see, it's not locked. And here comes the interesting thing. Here's 1/3 and 1/2 overlap. We take this point. Ah, I can get the 2 to 1, 2 to 1 for some initial conditions. I can get the 3 to 1, 3 to 1, 3 to 1 for some other initial conditions. Depends on initial condition. Fine. In phase space, it looks like it. By the way, here, three solutions, but just...
Do you get switching behavior between both of them?
What?
Do you get switching behavior?
Whole idea. Not deterministic. Not deterministic. In the deterministic system, I have a Bayesian of attraction of this term, another Bayesian attraction of that term. In biological systems, you have noise. You switch.
The noise is due to the...
That's the whole idea about this talk, yeah. So to say. Ah, further up, many, many overlap. Some are stable, some are unstable.
So just to,
please?
Yeah. I mean, so the quote-unquote noise is not something that arises from the chaotic dynamics, right?
Not at all.
If I had the
chaotic
system, it wouldn't stay in one...
Except, good point. So people discuss a lot in biology. What is extrinsic noise? What is external noise? What is what, right? Is it, yes. No, no, I mean... But it's foggy where you are, right?
No,
I understand your point. You say, if I can rephrase, you say, oh, I talk about chaos. Is that the one that creates the noise? We don't think so.
Yeah. Yeah. I would expect not.
Exactly. But we have the two tongues, so it jumps. But can I put, no, I mean, you know, it's...
it's but the other question is, supposing I take... this entire dynamical system.
Right.
And imagine that it's coupled to something else. Because
right.
What you need in order to switch between these different modes of
exactly.
So cycles is some displacement in the phase space, right?
That's true.
And this can be done deterministically as
that's
well.
Exactly true. Yeah, you need to switch from the two area and phase space. It's exactly true. And that's what we try to study these days. And what does the switching?
What does the switching mean? But it doesn't have to be noise.
It is noise, right? But what you can ask, what kind of noise? It's but as I showed you, you know, you don't see exactly a pendulum, right? You see, you know, it has noise and yeah. So so here comes, of course, when many overlap, you get a beautiful chaotic attractor. So clearly in the model, we can see beautiful transition to chaos in the good old Lorentz, Pierre doubling, whatever way. So I think I'm close to an hour. We should soon finish. But then we got contact to the group, as I was talking, who's now in Chicago, and convinced them. And I think maybe they also learned from other places, I don't know. But to, instead of having constant TNF, vary it. Now, as we have discussed, Savas has a system that can do sinusoidal. At that time, they could do kind of spikes decaying. Anyhow, periodic, and it's a long story. But what you find, you have a lot of cells in your microflow, and you can begin to see, oh, you see here. Here, of course, it's a transient noise. After some time, you see, they have entrained to the external. Can they do that better? Yes, what they did. I think it's a nice diagram here. You have, I think, around 100 cells on the y-axis and time on the x-axis. And here are the different external periods. And here are the different concentration of TNF. Anyhow, if you have high NF kappa B, you get light. And you see quite beautiful kind of wave pattern here. That means entrainment, right? And up here, not so much. It depends apparently on the period. Yes, it should, as we showed before. But here comes a biological trick, I think, in this actual cell paper, that some genes express more when it's entrained or not. Aha, now we begin to talk. Now we begin to talk that we can talk to the cell with an external periodic signal and make the genes produce more. Now it's getting deep, right? Okay, well, how did we come in? That I told them, you look, people, if they overlap, then you might see a switching. This is experimental series. So here is 1-to-1, here is 1-to-2. But every now and then we found series. And of course that depends on the external amplitude, as we have discussed, where it switches back and forth between the two states. So we have the two tongues overlapping, 1-1 and 1/2. And I don't know whether you noticed, we cannot agree whether it's 1/2 or 2/1 or whatever. It's a complete mess. And my students, we fight about that basically every day. Anyhow, it's a long story. But the experimental signals, we could see many, many cases where it jumped and many where it didn't. And how do we do this? Now I showed you deterministic simulations, now we do stochastic. There are two ways to do it. Either Lang-Chevang, we all know, you add noise. But there's a fantastic technique in genetic systems called Gillespie, because there you can vary the number of molecules. Of course, you can do that in Lang-Chevang too, but it's difficult. Here it's very well defined. And you write all the possible transitions, which is maybe around 20, and you take one of them depending on their rate. Very simple. And then you move one molecule to another. It's called Gillespie. We all love to do that, so to say. And okay, here's still deterministic. We sit, and I already showed you that. We have the two different, when two overlap, we have the two different possibilities, 1-to-2 and 1-to-1. Now we add noise. Aha!
When you say you add noise, you're doing Gillespie? Is that what you mean?
We do Gillespie. It's really smart. Ah, we add noise. Oops, you have more topping from one to the other back again. If we do it on the 1/2 and 1/3 here now, it jumps, stays here, jumps, stays here, and so on. Jumps back and forth. This is what I want to finish now. The whole idea with...
Sorry. So you have your system of equations.
I have a deterministic equation.
You do a stochastic implementation.
Exactly. Yes. I'm sorry. I have this deterministic equation. I write all the possible transitions. I get a list of say 20 rates for the different.
But then that's not your mean field rate equations, right?
Okay, I think we know, we talk about what. Yeah,
but
it's a
mean,
question.
Your mean field rate equations when your number of no. things.
But then I choose one of them according to their weight. And then I move one molecule from that state to the other. Yeah.
But your deterministic equations are, of course,
the starting point.
The noise washed out version of that.
No. But I guess this way, I think we agree, but you need to start with a deterministic because to write all the rates. Otherwise, I couldn't write the rates. I mean, it's sure. But anyhow, I mean, yes.
What are typical copy numbers?
That we vary quite a lot, 10 or something. Yeah. Honestly, sometimes we don't know what the copy number is. So here you see transitions, and here comes what I will end with in relation to this program. How long time does it like to stay in one before it switches? How does it build in memory here before it jumps? So this is, I hope you can see ties to this program. That's quite interesting, you see. Do we know that beforehand? Not at all.
Do you have some information on the residence times?
Yeah, I'm going to end. Thank you. I'm going to end by that. I just want to show you, if we go high up here, we have a chaotic state. How does the chaotic state here a little relate to your question? Well, my students say sometimes I don't know how strong this statement is. He can see even the unstable states. There's a sort of hangs maybe a little bit around and is kicked away. But I would say this is a speculation. Nevertheless, we can certainly find on the deterministic. This is stochastic, right? This deterministic. Stochastic, it jumps up a little back and forth. Deterministic, we get a standard Strange Attractor. just before I come to the time, we played around. So you could say, oh, what is this useful for? I already showed you what Savastai found, that different genes behave. And that was measurement, by the way. So here we, so that was entrainment. Is mode hopping biologically relevant? This is still only speculation. And just very fast, we play with two genes. One has high affinity. What does that mean? It binds strongly. But low cooperativity only binds a few. Here's low affinity. High cooperativity binds a lot. And we can see that these two cases, we can see mode hopping enhances one, and it jumps, it enhances the other. Here comes what I end by time correlations, the whole idea that if it spends roughly half time, and it's still we are working on, but it's good for this meeting here. If it spends roughly half the time in each, we see I'll show you, it's exponentially distributed. Let me show you. It's exponentially distributed the times. Fine. So I would say kind of no memory, maybe like just crossing a barrier. Cramer's kind of idea. If one dominates more than the other, the time, this. So what? Here's just the probability to stay in that tongue, and it gets kind of stress exponential. So in that sense, we think here it builds in longer memory because it hangs around. It hangs around for a longer time.
So when you go away from the people.
Yes. Yes. And that is by moving in the diagram, you know, changing amplitude and whatever. And we don't quite understand when it happens, honestly. But we can definitely see that sometimes one is more dominant than the other. And it certainly builds in some time correlations and memory before it jumps. And just to end, we have taken the same system, simplified a little bit. We have a negative feedback loop. We have the external period here. External oscillator, it couples, blah, blah, blah. Long story. Then to simplify, we have over two stable solutions. Now you see Matthias called 3/1 before, it was 1/3. We get confused here, but I'm sorry. We have stable solutions. We do a cut just to simplify. And you see jumps, you know, see jumps from one. And here clearly this one stays much longer than the other, right? A lot of noise.
So this is stochastic.
Definitely. I mean, this is deterministic. Here you are, right? These are the limit cycle. Now you do stochastic and you look at this crossing. And there are lots of things just to understand here, and we are not done. But here are some initial points, and I think he iterated it around 40 times or something, and says, oh, if I know it ends in one, so for all the, he colored them, these initial points end in one tongue, these initial points end in the other tongue. In between, it didn't decide. And this, of course, called in the deterministic sense, Bayesian of attraction. And we have here the, and you can see the Bayesian of attraction moves with the amplitude, because this is deterministic, long story, but this is what we try to do. And my last slide. Is this a number of oscillations before leaving the tongue? So how long does it like to have a time kind of, I would call memory in this conference, but time correlation before it leaves? And we change, you see here, period, we change the tongue from 3/1 to 2/1, and we change the period, and we change the noise. And what we find is it's not exponential. Generally, only if noise is very high. And that makes sense. If noise is very high, it's like a Cramer's kind of a stochastic resonance, as we discussed, or whatever you want to call it. It switches back and forth, fine. But in other systems, you see the exponential plot is green, and it's definitely not. So it builds in some memory. It likes to stay in one more than the other. As Matthias has found, stress exponential is not so good either. We think right now, and this is pure kind of, what should I say, empirical. We see that the sum of two exponentials actually fit our data, but we don't really know. It's clearly not exponential. That's the main story. So clearly, I say again, it builds in some memory to stay in one tongue more than the other before it decides to jump. And I think I just want to finish by this diagram, which I think is deeper than one think. And very briefly, are there there are very, very few who have thought about Arnold tongues in biological systems. Goldbeater has a model for coupling between cell cycle and circadian clock. And find, and this is, so to say, what we feel will, well, actually here it's coupled to cell cycle, so, but nevertheless, you get at Arnold tongue for the 24 period and 48 period and 48 hours, sorry, and so on. So with cell cycle, you can get, and Jeff Hasty in UC San Diego has looked at bacteria, population genetic oscillators, and found some indication of Arnold tongues. But there's very little in the literature, so I think there's lots of things to do. Thank you very much. Yes?
How entwined are your bases of attraction?
That's a good question.
Because that actually,
Matthias found, I have many slides here, you can see. How? So, this is, okay. This is your answer to your question.
Yeah, okay, so
but, unfortunately, I mean, this is a little more showcase because for the one I showed you before, we think there's a relatively sharp boundary. This is a little away from the relevant biological state, actually. But you can find such things.
But you also ask, how far to from the actual attractor to the nearest point on the boundary? Because
yes,
that would sort of set the minimum, the smallest noise that would actually kick you into the act.
We exactly study this right now.
Okay.
We start different. We start at the boundary. We start a little in and see whether it can jump one way, the other, or jump back, and so on. Absolutely.
So in terms of
this is deterministic, though.
These are deterministic ones.
But I don't see there's no way of it to tell balance. So would you sort of naturally get two different exponents if you just did a simple model like you say? Because I don't see why
we
have to
debate.
That
wasn't trying to explain that. That was just a question.
All right, let me follow up and ask.
You mean the fit of the two exponentials?
Yeah,
we think about this exactly. Whether you have kind of one to one side and another to another.
Well, and when you work that out, do you get two different exponentials? Because again, it's not until balance, or it depends what you do to your rates, I guess.
Yeah, we kind of get, yeah. That's at least Matthias' hypothesis right now. I don't want to put it.
Oh,
through.
I see. Okay.
But we kind of get. Yes.
Wait. Okay. I interrupted.
I was just going to say, you see the same spread to exponential behavior with just a circle map plus noise, or is it only in your interview?
I definitely haven't looked at it, and I try to think. That's a very good question. You didn't look at. That's a very good question. I don't know.
Every time you see a stretch exponential, that can also be fit by some of those conditions, right?
Oh yes, you can do an integral of exponential. Okay, yep, absolutely.
Yeah, because it just.
But that's an infinite sum, right? Kind of.
Yeah. No, but you just don't have that much data, so
yes,
it'll work.
Yes. But it's true. Absolutely, it's true. You're right.
So I'm confused about something basic, and I also have a question about these kind of diagrams. Now, so forget the biological system for the first question.
Good.
If you're just looking at the dynamical system you're studying, is it chaotic or it's not? The attractor is chaotic or not? Or,
okay, in this case,
yeah.
I think it is. I think that's why I said we have much higher amplitude in this case than we had before, where we just have the two states.
So then.
No, wait. No. I'm sorry. No. Because this shows you whether you go to one or the other. I'm sorry. Thank you. I I got confused in my head here. Yeah. Absolutely.
So it's
here you had two. Here you had two stable, one blue and one yellow, and these are the initial conditions that take you one. Sorry.
So now, in terms of the sort of the design, now this is a more biologically relevant question.
Right.
So assuming that there is some purpose you serve by switching between these two.
Yes.
I mean, if the sort of the interleaving of these different sort of basins too dense, it can probably not be a good design, right? Because even small amounts of noise can kick you from one to the other. But you want it to be accessible. So how?
Whole idea, you know, this kind of thing can be fractal, right?
Will it be a good thing if it's a
practice? It's kind of either good or bad, depends on how you look at it, I would say. But you're absolutely right. A noise, of course, will smear the fractal. And then it doesn't make sense, this diagram. I would say, the big bands. I mean, there you have to weight the amplitude of the noise with the structure, right? For instance, say if you start here and add noise, you still get yellow. If you start here and add noise, you have no idea whether you become yellow or blue.
Exactly. Yeah. So there needs to be some robustness of the different cycles.
Of course. And this is, again, of course, a discussion, deterministic noise. And, you know, for years I worked on deterministic systems. So it's much, in some sense, much deeper.
So then you could kind of just sort of to confirm that picture, do kind of this, suppose you have this, you know, the top face picture, right? And then you run experiments. You start your system
yes.
in the center of the yellow, you add some noise, and you look how long it switches.
Exactly.
And then you correlate the switching time to how close you are between the yellow-blue boundary and so on.
Exactly. You can do exactly controlled experiment. That way I agree.
Numerically,
you can. You know, when you say an experiment, it's, oh, can't you start with so much of that and so much of that? It's not so easy. But in principle, this is the way to do it. This is the way to control it, right? Absolutely. And this is a way to balance deterministic to noise. And I would say this is what exactly we try to this mode hopping. That's why I, you know, have learned a lot of new things by doing this, because this is exactly the issue, right? When does it jump and when does it stay for a long time and so on. People are exhausted with good and bad reasons.
Okay, if there are no more questions, let's start.
Thank you.